Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must-listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, Janine Vosper, and welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. All the way from Vermont, I have Dana Kasperson. Dana is the author of a new book called Conflict is an Opportunity, 20 Fundamental Decisions for Navigating Difficult Times. She is a conflict engagement specialist, best-selling author, TEDx speaker, and award-winning performing artist. When I read the performing artist part of your bio, Dana, I thought, I want to dig into that a little bit more. That was intriguing. She works with individuals, organizations, and communities worldwide as a trainer, coach, consultant, and dialogue designer. That was the other thing that I went, okay, that needs some discussion as well. Drawing on her knowledge and insight gained from her experience training as a mediator and conflict analyst. We're just talking about me making sure that I can get my words together first thing this morning, so I think I'll be all right, as well as her 40-year career in performing arts innovator. Dana empowers people and organizations to navigate complex and challenging situations. Welcome, Dana. Lovely, lovely to speak with you this morning, evening.
Yes, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to join you.
I read that and I went, okay, conflict and then performer. It doesn't seem to tie together, but I'm sure you'll explain how it does tie together.
Yeah, so initially I didn't think it tied together either, and I really tried to keep them separate because I didn't want to kind of contaminate one with the other. And then I actually had an experience where I, the first public dialogue project I did, was just horrible. It was so tense. People were afraid to talk. It was, the whole atmosphere was very stiff. And I come from theater, you know, where you're shaping environments, you're shaping experience, you're directing attention, you're enabling certain things and keeping other things from not happening. And I thought, okay, I have completely thrown the baby out with the bathwater here. And so I started thinking about, okay, how does choreographic decision-making impact what I'm doing in conflict? And I started bringing it in more and more. And now I realize that the two fields are very connected in that they're both asking the same questions, which is, given where we are, what else might be possible? Not by throwing out where we are, but by saying, okay, what are the materials of the present and how might they transform? And so for me, I really find them very connected now, that it's about recognizing that conflict and polarizing situations are spaces of creative action, even when they really don't feel like it.
Oh, no, I absolutely love that. And the other thing is, you know, because of my background as a sales coach, I'm always asking my clients to say, well, what makes you unique? And that makes you unique. You can't, and people forget all of those years of skills of doing something else, how it can be applied to what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that often happens in the field of the arts. It's quite siloed, excuse me, and we don't recognize that these technologies, I see the arts as kind of a very advanced technology for enabling experience and communication. And that not only that, but what I realize now is that choreographic decision-making, so how we shape space and bodies and configuration and time, all these things that choreographers are thinking of all the time, everybody's thinking about all the time. So it's really useful to recognize, okay, a lot of these decisions are being made unconsciously. And if we make them consciously, we have a much better chance of creating the kind of situations that we want to be part of. So I feel it's a, not only does it lie in the world of the arts, but it lies everywhere. It's the creative possibility inside of all of the mess.
And the beauty of that also is that sometimes we put away our creative space when we're in our business space. And often, you know, that things are changing so quickly, we need to be able to adapt. And if we're very left brain and thinking one and one makes two, we forget that sometimes that we can add up things differently and create something different. So yeah, I think I love it.
And I think, what that power is the power to imagine something taking place that is not currently taking place. And a lot of times imagination gets seen as kind of a frivolous thing or, kind of childish and certainly not a serious thing. And at the same time, it's that when that capacity is missing, that's when we get stuck. But when we have the capacity and the mindset and the wherewithal to say, okay, let me take a step back here and think, what else might happen here? What haven't we noticed yet? What don't we know? What do we need to know? Where do we want to go, and what will help us get there? And
And
imagination is key.
yeah, the ima amazing imagination of the great thinkers, and you just wonder where it comes from. It always blows me away. And the one person I'm thinking particularly of at the moment is Elon Musk. But politically, we're not going into anything, but his ability to just go, oh, I'll just design a house that's fully resourced and people can have it for $10,000. Or I'll get people back from space and this is how I'm going to do it, or I'm going to do electric car, whatever it is. There's brand, minds like that that are just beyond our thinking that.
Yeah, and it's curious to think. So a mind that has curiosity, has capacity to be creative, and yet is not framed within a moral universe that helps other people thrive, is also a danger. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I think the capacity to be creative can go either way. So we can create, fascist structures, or we can create places where people can really thrive and work together, because oftentimes there's this idea that either we're powerful or we're not powerful. But in fact, there is power everywhere in all the systems, and we can build power together. And that's not a idealistic thing. It's like a true reflection of the way the world is interdependent. And I find that that's actually the important counter thing to imagination is the recognition of interdependence.
So, Dana, for you, I mean, what were you doing in the world of theatre and choreography, and then how did you get into what you're doing now, and then go, right, I've written this book, it's a decision.
Yeah. So I was working as a performer and a creator in dance and theater. And there was just so much conflict in my life at a certain point, and I really just didn't have any skills to deal with it. And I was so tired of it. And I thought, there's just got to be some other way to do this. And a friend of mine dragged me to a workshop. And in the course of the workshop, I had like one of those literal light bulb moments where I thought, oh my, yeah, it really doesn't have to be this way. And then I got more and more curious, kind of just out of self-defense, started studying for myself for several years. And then I started to see how things unfold differently when we ask different questions, when we approach things with a different mindset. And so then eventually I went and got a degree and started working in the field. So it grew out of a desperation, and then it became something that was such a relief to realize is possible, that I really wanted to continue and learn more about it. And I keep learning more about it every day.
And I think for most coaches, they come from a space of exactly that. I had a problem. I learned how to fix that problem. And now I want to share that with as many people as I possibly can. If I've considered dumb that down, it's as easy as that. And because you have this full understanding of what the problem is, because you've experienced it, it means that you can step into the shoes of the people that you're trying to assist as well.
Yeah, and I think also to this point of what was the transition, is that the way dancers work is they come back every day and they do things again, but they don't repeat things. They reconnect to ideas and figure out how they're manifesting now. And that's the way I approach conflict too, not like, okay, here's the right technique and here's you use I language and then everything's going to be fine. But instead, how do we develop an adaptable mindset, a capacity to see where we are? And that's what this new book, Conflict is an Opportunity, is in that works that same way to say, okay, we're inside all of these decisions that we're already making. Are we making them consciously? Where are we, where do we want to go? What do we want to be able to see? And how do we make that more possible through the decisions that we make so that it's something we re-enliven every day rather than something that we exterior thing that we have to learn.
And being conscious, in conscious of everything is very different than living unconsciously. The whole experience is quite different when you can step back and look at your response, or even when you're actually in a situation to be able to sort of transfer yourself and look at and go, oh, okay, I see I'm doing that. I wonder why I chosen to do it that particular way at that time.
And I think that gets to the point that attention is one of the most important things, the most important powers that we have to be able to consciously direct our attention, because often our attention goes habitually to somebody attacked me, I'm going to defend myself. So kind of cycles of attack and defense or blame. And if we can, like you say, take a step back and say like, wow, okay, I fell right back into that whole attack defense cycle. Let me take a breath. Let me consciously shift my attention instead to figuring out what's happening. What matters to me? What matters to the other person? Do we have the information on the table that's going to actually allow us to move forward in a way that makes sense to both of us enough that whatever we decide to do is going to be sustainable and is going to be effective instead of trying to jam through one person's strategy, for example?
Yeah, so there's not a winner.
Oftentimes it's a people see it as win-lose. It's a battle that we have to either survive or win, and then we lose so much life. We lose so much energy, and we miss so much information. And I think that really gets back to this idea that we can build power together, not in a utopian way, but in a real way to figure out what everybody needs and what that means might be possible.
Yes, it's I'm just thinking, different situations where there always seems to have to be a winner for something, and if you haven't won, well then you feel like you've been hard done by, and at some stage you'll get back at that person because you haven't won in this situation. And I it happens, doesn't it?
The retribution. And a lot of times people say either, okay, they try to shove through their own strategy, but then that leaves the other person resentful, and then there'll be retribution, and then it just repeats. So those kind of it's kind of a violent cycle that repeats, and it
Definitely.
feels permanent, but it's not.
I've noticed with myself that as I have matured in years, that I really don't care as much. It's, oh, okay. I'm not going to change that person's opinion of something. It's, and yeah, that's okay. I'll just let it go. I can give you as much evidence as possible, but if that's the way you choose to be, then whereas I know I possibly, wouldn't have, would I know, possibly, what a silly word. I know I would not have done that in the past.
And through experience, you've come to realize it's impossible to change other people, and it also is a pointless undertaking. But we have such capacity to shift our own perception of what's happening and what we offer, which does in effect tend to res make pr tend to provoke a different response in the people. Because if I come at you with an attack, you're going to be defensive right away. It almost always happens. But if I come with real curiosity, like, hey, I've noticed this is going on. I'm wondering what's going on with what you're thinking, and if we could have a conversation about it, it's much more likely that you'll be willing to do that.
And that's a great technique, that curious question. So I'm just thinking, I'm I can adapt that when I'm in the coaching mode or with other people, but it's really hard when the person you've been living with for 45 years, it's just sort of, because that's a real thing, isn't it?
Patterns.
Oh, I can't be bothered being pussyfooting around it. I just want to go in on the attack sometimes, or not necessarily attack, but I just want to
Yeah,
make a point, you know?
right. That's it. Then that's such a great example, because oftentimes then we feel like we're making our point, but in fact we're just kind of offering them a sneaky attack, and we haven't really talked about what we care about on the more fundamental level. And I think those kind of, we get some kind of hardened patterns going on, and they start to feel like that's just the way it is. And it really takes like a strong curiosity to say, okay, whoa, I've noticed we've been doing this for 40 years. And it doesn't feel good. Like, I don't think it's making our life better. What do you think? Could we talk about what else we could do here when this happens? That those kind of, with a real curiosity, like a robust kind that's willing to listen, willing to consider, not trying to win the strategy, but to try to really understand what's happening for you? What do you care about the most in this?
Yeah, I love that. Oh, think about that one. No, it does make a difference. So that absolutely, that curious factor. When it comes to women though, in conflict, I think there's a couple of ways we go, isn't there? There's either sort of letting people railroad them, or really coming on the attack, the defense. Is how do women avoid that?
And I think that has to do with the way the society tends to judge women for being either too aggressive or too passive. And so there's this kind of narrowed area where people perceive this is where I can walk. And I think stepping out of that story and really just coming to these basic actions of developing a curious mindset, being willing to stay with it even when other people shut down, being willing to and capable of describing topics without attack or defense. So say, instead of, on a mundane example, instead of saying like, oh my God, I'm so tired of you not doing the dishes. You always expect me to do anything, everything. You're such a slob. Instead of having those attack and defense and opinions, taking all that out and saying, hey, I want to talk about how we share household tasks so that we can describe, not keeping emotion out of it. We might still be really frustrated and say, I'm really frustrated because I find that we end up doing the same thing around this every time, and I'm exhausted. And I want to have a what feels to me like a more fair way of dividing up household tasks, and we talk about that. So I think for women to stay curious, be capable of describing things in a way that's not doesn't contain attack and defense, and yet really describes what matters to you. To see emotion as a signal, as opposed to somewhere we can get stuck in, but the emotion is there because something matters to us. I am furious about this because it's really important to me that I have autonomy in this situation, for example. So not being afraid to express the emotion, because the emotion is part of how we think, and it also helps people understand where we're coming from. But always connecting it to what matters to us on the level of, let's say, needs or interests, for example, autonomy or the capacity to have a clarity around the decision-making process in a project, to be able to describe those things. And then another actually really important thing that I find is super helpful is to distinguish between acknowledgement and agreement. So oftentimes we become afraid to acknowledge what somebody else says because we feel like that'll be an agreement when we really don't agree with them. But to recognize there's real freedom and power in being able to say, okay, so it sounds like to you it makes sense to do this and this. Is that right? Okay. Yeah. And what's important in that for you? Okay. Yeah. And so here's what I'm thinking around it. Here's what's important to me, so that we're not afraid to get other people's information on the table, because we don't have to be in reaction to it, pulled or pushed by it. Let them be over there with their thoughts. Let that be an important part to put on the table, and be with ourself, able to acknowledge, because it doesn't mean that we either agree or disagree. Those are some fundamental things.
Yeah, I That's so important. And you know what just popped into my head? I'm part of organizations where we run business meetings. And where somebody that will move a motion and then someone will second it, but the seconder doesn't have to agree with it. They're just seconding the motion. It's very similar sort of aspect. I don't have to agree with it, but let's discuss it. And that's really what that is in that space. And it just came to me. That's exactly
That's
what you're doing.
interesting. Yeah, exactly. You're saying, okay, yeah, so that sounds like a topic. And but oftentimes people will bring the topic in with like a strategy attached, like we should do this. Okay, so you're thinking we should do this. And then what is it about that that's important? So then the topic you can second their like bringing it into the space and then say, and then let's figure out what's in that. Why is that important to you? What would that help with?
And then, depending what it is, debate the, which is
Talk
different than
about.
argue. I love debates because you can bring information in, and now if you're in a debate, then I'll be listening to the opposite side go, that's a really good point. I'm going to
Because
argue
if
it in a debate because that's
you're
what I'm
right.
going to do, but it is a very good point.
There's a wonderful peacemaker named Jean-Paul Lederach, and he talks about what he calls the four disciplines that help people step out of violent systems. And the first one is the ability to see ourselves as being in relationship to our enemies. And the second one is the curiosity to be able to be with complexity without falling into duality. So just like you named, that we can be in a complex situation where we disagree, and yet there might be parts of what people are saying where you say, yeah, right, that's I get that. That's a good point. So that it becomes a space where there's mobility for everybody. We're not like on our side and fighting for it and then pushing them away. But we're like, okay, what's the question between us? And that's often the thing that doesn't either we think we have one, but we actually both have different questions between us. But if we can really figure out what the question between us is, then it's something that we're working on together, even if we disagree. And then that's a creative space.
And yes, my mind goes everywhere when I sort of hear it. It just sort of zips off onto a totally different, well, not an analogy usually is where I keep thinking of the things that you're saying. But what I'm thinking as well is when you're going into workplaces, I'm assuming then there may be an odd person that might have, this is not necessary, this is not for me. And they've got a block up getting through because, oh no, well, my workplace told me I had to be here. So that,
Oh, when I go into places, you mean? So what I find is really important is that I don't go in with techniques. I don't go in with telling people what they should be doing. My curiosity is around, okay, what do you notice is happening in the situation? So say there's a organization that's having a lot of conflict. Then we'll spend time saying, okay, so what are the things that you're noticing are happening? Let's get all that stuff on the table. What matters to you in this? And then we can talk about it. So it's a process of opening up. Sometimes people might be like, oh my God, this is another one of those conflict resolution things. I'm gonna just sit through this whole thing again and nothing's gonna change. And so I actually don't go into organizations unless the people who have the power to make decisions can fully explain to me why we're doing this and that they're actually going to follow through. Because otherwise, it basically inoculates people against any kind of future work. So I work first with the decision makers to say, okay, what is this for? And why are you asking people for input? What will be done with this input? How can people know that there's a reason for them to do this and they're not just either being utilized or just being kind of pacified? So that I come in and actually I also don't work with groups that where it's mandatory because it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it really makes no sense. So I say that, anybody who wants to work, anybody who approaches me, I say I only work with people who want to be there. And then when the people come, I also say it again, like, hey, my experience is that it only makes sense for people to be here who want to be here. So if you don't want to be here, please feel free to to step out whenever you want to. And but what I find is that once people get a sense that what we're working on is not that I'm going to tell you how to deal with conflict, but instead we're looking at what do you notice about what's in your situation, what might be possible, what gets in the way, what if there were change, what might that look like? And then developing this your own mindset, as opposed to having some sort of external framework jammed down your throat. I find that's a big difference.
Yeah, people will take ownership of that then, but it's also validating their opinions, which is such an important part. It's one of the things when I talk about sales training all the time, it's validation, validating or whatever it is, validating someone else's opinion, idea, or you know, if someone's being difficult, it's still validated, and then move it around.
And then move it around. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens is to give people a different experience of validation, because a lot of times people come into a workshop having already had a bunch of arguments about some particular topic and they're done. They're just so tired of it. But to then be able to acknowledge, first of all, people come in with an opinion, acknowledge the opinion, but then validate what's under it. Because that's what they really care about, even though it often feels to us in conflict when we come with an opinion, like we've expressed what matters to us, but usually we've just expressed a strategy. And so when the group gets used to differentiating between strategies and what matters really underneath, that also opens up a big space that people, there's a little more motion. So they're not getting stuck on a typical sticking points, but they're opening up this more generative space of like, all right, yeah, what does matter to me? And what really matters to you in this? Yeah.
And the opportunity then, if, you know, the learning that in the workplace is then taking it out into their home life and the real world. It's a bit of a ripple effect then, isn't it? Because it makes a difference elsewhere if people can learn.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I find is that people, you know, I teach courses a lot, and I try to teach courses that happen over time and not just short courses, because people need to have the opportunity to try things out, run into problems, come back, think about it. And people really name that after a while, like your brain changes. You just start paying attention to different things. So you shift the patterns of attention into things that tend to make things work better, tend to get you the information that you want, tend to allow you to express yourself in ways that people can hear you, and tend to move toward ways forward out of places where they thought they could never move out of. Yeah.
And is that what you mean by when I first introduced the dialogue? I'm just looking where I said it, but the dialogue designer? Is that what you mean with that? That you help them form their words better? Is that?
Well, actually, the dialogue design has to do with actual public dialogue projects.
Right.
So I do, So I do kind of large scale public dialogues on conflictual topics. For example, I'm going down to Texas next week to do a project on polarization, and it's a large scale public dialogue, and it utilizes actually choreographic practice. So it's not dancing or anything like that, but it's designed in a way that people, it allows and kind of enables people to have different types of conversations about polarization, about polarized topics. So I design kind of instances of different experience, and similar to kind of what we were just talking about, when people have an experience like, wow, and then I had this conversation that I've actually never had a conversation with a stranger about something that on that level, on that deeper level of what matters to me, then that becomes more possible for them going forward in their life too. So I try to create these instances of different exchange. And so I use choreographic decision-making in that, in terms of how we configure the bodies. So for example, often I have people walking side by side as opposed to sitting at tables and looking. Or I'll use the body as a way to answer things in really simple ways, for example, with your hands, or configure people in the space in a way that gives them different internal sensations. So I'll use physical sensations as a way to reflect on your own thinking around things, on your own experiences. So that's what I mean with dialogue design, although they're the same kind of principles are present all the time when I'm working with people in an organization, for example, on a smaller level.
I'm finding that quite intriguing. I've never heard of anyone doing anything like that before. Is that something that you tend to see in the US, or is this just something that
you know, I don't know. I actually don't know. I got into it because, like I said, one of my first experiences was a terrible public dialogue. And I started thinking a lot about, for example, one project was on racism, and because I was noticing how hard it was for people to talk about racism. So I thought, okay, what might make it more possible for people to have a different kind of conversation about racism? And so I developed it out of the interest in enabling things that I didn't see happening. So for example, the polarization project, it's not that nobody's talking about any particular topic. They're talking about polarization and what they, how it ends up in them, what it does with them, what they do with it, how we can unfold it so it doesn't become this kind of monolithic us versus them. But like we were talking about before, that there's this mobility, there's where these there's perceived borders between us become much more permeable. And there's much more capacity for us to have a different kind of conversation.
That sounds fascinating. So you just sort of advertise, here we are, we're doing this public thing, people are welcome? Is that the
start? Yeah, I mean, now I always work with local, there has to be kind of local leaders involved because I can't just roll in there and do it myself. So I work with, for example, I'm working with a group down there and they are inviting people from the community. So my experience is that I've tried many different ways. And, you know, if you say, come to the choreographic public dialogue on racism, like no one's going to show up.
No, no.
I probably wouldn't show up. You know, God, it could be so horrible. And so what we tend to do is reach out to leaders and say, okay, look, here's this thing. Here's why we think it could be valuable. Will you bring 10 people so that we get people from different communities coming together? Because people most of the time won't come on their own.
No, it sounds fascinating. I'll be interested to know how it goes when you do that.
Yeah,
it's certainly not something that I've heard of. And again, that's your uniqueness that brings in the choreography, brings in the use of the body. But just going back to that, so you were a dancer or?
Yes, I was a dancer and actress for 30 years, professional. Yeah.
Stage, TV?
Yeah, stage.
Stage?
Performing artists. I was in a touring company, essentially, for most of the time in the Ballet Frankfurt and the Forsyth Company, based in Germany.
Wonderful.
Yes,
I've been catching up on my theatre the last couple of weeks here because they had certain rules attending for a couple of years that didn't suit my enjoyment of watching the show, so I waited till they removed all those conditions, and then yes, in catching up, and we it's been I love the theater experience. It's such a different vibe than sitting watching a movie, which is enjoyable as well, but I took my grandchildren, I've often taken them to the children's theatres, shows and productions, and I took them to see Christmas Carol at Christmas time. It was a very intense, quite scary with the ghost, the way they did the ghost production was brilliant.
Yeah.
So Miss 8-year-old was a little bit not sure, but they loved it. They loved everything that was produced on stage, so hopefully it builds a love of theater but that as well.
I came up in a there were when I was I grew up in Minneapolis in Minnesota, and there was a children's theater school that was connected to a professional theater. So I grew up in a children's theater doing performances, and that was formative for me for sure.
And it does make a difference just having the opportunity to experience it. It's like anything, isn't it? Even, what you're talking about with the conflict, if you have never had the opportunity to experience a different way to approach a subject, you're not going to know how to do it. It's just, it's a life experiences.
At one point, I was studying what kind of training goes on for young people in conflict. And one of the papers I was reading said, children who do not learn conflict resolution, who are not taught conflict resolution, do not learn it. I was like, that's such a great, simple way of doing it. What we don't get taught, we don't learn. And what we can't imagine, back to imagination, what we can't imagine doing, we don't do. And so I think the capacity to imagine and also to enable imagination in other people is so important, because that's when we can say, like, okay, maybe there's a way out of this, not by getting rid of it, but by recognizing that this can transform where we are. We have that capacity.
And with, children have an amazing capacity for imagination, and which is being, depending on the amount of device time that they have, it's sort of being taken away, that because the things are just done for them on screen, they just got to press a button. Whereas if they're outside playing and they decide that they're going to build a cubby house out of some local branches, they've fallen down off a tree during a storm, it's a very different capacity to imagine something. And that, isn't it, that's such an important aspect of,
And so interesting to think for all of us. You were mentioning before that in business, sometimes we can get really stiff and serious, and to think, okay, what does it mean that to have imagination here? Not as kind of like a frivolous thing, but as a real foundational element of creativity and transformation. What might that look like in the situation that I'm in?
And that's just a brilliant question on any topic. What might that look like? I, when I'm working with clients for business, that's one of the questions that I ask them. What are you building? What do you want your business to look like? And most people, it's just silence. They, I don't know. I can't picture it. I've just got into business because I'm good at doing this particular thing. I'm a good technician at it. And now I'm business. Well, what do you want to create? What do you want it to look like?
What might it look like? And sometimes that the might part of it is what helps people, particularly in conflict, because then you're getting away from, like, okay, what should we do, to what might it look like if we did find a way forward. When people say, well, but there's no way forward, well, if there were one, like, just to hypothetically speaking, what might it look like? What would need to be in place? What do people want to see? And so it opens up again this imaginative space that has room for motion.
I love that word, might. I'm going to use that. Definitely going to use that because it might does create that imagination.
It takes the pressure off too.
And it does. And even when the siblings, the grandchildren are arguing, it's the, okay, so what might it be, how would the afternoon might go if you two aren't arguing with each other?
What if it was really fun and we found a way for that you both wanted to do? What might that look like?
Well, these two are pretty good. They don't argue very often with each other, which is really not really nice. As we've been talking, you've offered some techniques, curiosity and imagination in particular. Is there anything else that people can go, okay, that I'll apply that. That's really going to help me.
So one fundamental thing that I think is really important and can at first seem kind of counterintuitive is to differentiate between requests and demands. So oftentimes in a conflict, we feel like we need to be really serious, we need to make some demands. And if I make a demand of you, Then you've only got two choices. I've framed it. You can either comply with my demand or you can defy. And so then I've created a situation where not only are you put in a box, but if you say no, then I've failed. And so it creates a framework, a stiff framework with a very narrow way forward. But a request, and a real request where it's okay, where I'm okay if you say no, is if I stay with myself, I stay with what matters. So again, getting back to this question of like, what do I really care about? I might have a strategy I think would work, but that strategy is just a strategy. If I stay with what matters to me and I say, hey, I'm thinking about this. Here's what matters to me. I want to find out more about what you're thinking around this. And then I make a request. It might be, can we talk about this? Or here's one thing I'm thinking might work well. And what do you think? And then if you're like, no, I don't think so, then that's just information for me. Okay, so it sounds like that wouldn't work for you. What is it about it that wouldn't work? What are you finding is really important to you here? So that a request becomes this kind of like investigative tool. So differentiating between those two things, demands shut things down, are a dead end. A request opens things further up and invites people in without kind of putting them in a box. So that's a fundamental thing to just start practicing, noticing the difference. Am I making demands here or am I making a request? And knowing it's a real request if you're willing for the person to say no. Because then if you're not willing for them to say no, then you're probably attached to your strategy as opposed to what matters. And you can say, okay, right, let me get back with myself, what I'm actually caring about. Okay, here's what I care about. Here's one strategy. So that we get more freedom and we get more space to move inside of tricky situations.
And both have a very different feeling of energy, both those words.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And oftentimes they get really conflated, you know.
When I'm teaching delegation, I often bring up the story. I ran a school fair when my children were in primary school, and so I went to meet with this woman who I knew had beautiful gardens, and to ask her to run the garden tables and, plants for sale and things like that. And she answered. She said, "You know what? That is, you just honored me by asking me to do that. I, you know, you considered that I could actually do that is just amazing. Unfortunately, at the time, I'm too busy to take that on. But I really appreciate you asking me." And I walked away and gone, she said no. It was a very nice no. But it was okay. It wasn't, I wasn't holding attachment to it. You're saying yes or no. But I thought, what a beautiful way to phrase it when you want to be able to say no sometimes. You can too, can't you?
Yeah, so she framed it as you offering her something of value too.
Which was very, very different. And even part of, with the conflict conversation, if you're offering suggestions or strategies, as you're saying, that is, again, it's offering it in a way that this could be of value to us, and being able to frame rather than saying we must do this, then it kind of comes back to that sales conversation again. How can I explain it so someone's going to see that it's of value?
Yeah, so if I bring my strategy in, it's a value because it will help with this. And it's the this that's important so that we could say, okay, the strategy, yeah, it would help with this in one way, but it won't help with this. All right, so what would it look like if we found something that would help with both things? So opening again that question between you, something you're both working on. Yeah, I had never thought of it in relationship to sales. That's interesting.
No, I think if everything's sort of, well, everything's around communication, whatever it is. And in sales, what doesn't work is, in the long term, is, that push and getting people to do things that they don't want to do. What works in the long term is having a win-win for all. That's a very simple definition of it, but it's everyone feels like they've got value out of it. Everyone's happy with the result.
And that's when the conflict is this opportunity because conflicts happen because something matters to people.
Ooh.
And if we find out what matters, then the tensions of conflict actually become the point that where we can something new can emerge. We can say, like, why does this tension happen? It's because this matters to me, this matters to you. Okay. So Ooh. Then it becomes this opportunity for us to take the energy of the conflict and move toward the transformation that it's proposing.
Yes, it would have been very useful in 2020, 20 or 21, with some lot of conflicts that were going on at that particular time. We normally finish up with three takeaways. You've given so much great information. And just so people can go, right, those three things, I'll definitely remember those. Can you please share what your three final takeaways are, Dan?
Sure, let's see. So where did I put my three takeaways? Okay, here we go. So kind of to just what I said is that people get into conflict because something matters to them. So find out what that is. And that's the first step to moving towards some kind of constructive outcome. And then really see conflict as an opportunity for constructive change, because that's what opens up these broader possibilities. So we often get into conflict either, like we said before, as a battleground or as something to just like avoid at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
But instead to say, my husband and I, after many, you know, so many years of my work, now when a conflict comes up, we're like, oh, good, it's a conflict. Excellent. Let's figure out what's happening. It's so informative. And then the third thing I would say is that conflict is inevitable, and we can expect it and we can plan for it together. We can create cultures of conflict together that help us actually help life be better. And it's in our control how we respond to conflict. And that's something that we can practice in little ways every day.
That is brilliant. And that's with anything in life. The only thing we really have control over is ourselves and our response to situations. We can't change others.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And primarily that's why I wrote the book in this way, is that it comes down to what decisions we make, and we are the only ones who have the power to make those decisions. And these decisions are with us all the time. And it's really an empowering space to recognize that I can practice this every day, making these decisions consciously. And it makes a huge difference in my life, in my perception of the world, and my interaction with others.
I've so enjoyed our conversation, and it's given me a reminders. And I think that, you know, people are listening as well. I am sure they would be, you know, thinking like I am, okay, yes, I do need to remember sometimes that I don't want to be demanding things. I need to be requesting and to, you know, what's the important factor?
Right. And to notice, and just to keep noticing things. Mm-hmm. So not, there's not one way to do it, but to notice what you're doing and how it's impacting. I've really enjoyed this conversation too. I appreciated all the different kind of metaphors that you brought in or situations that help kind of illuminate. That was really interesting. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's where my mind, the images pop in, and how they interact with what you're saying. And there's always a purpose behind it. Dana, how can people get your book, and how can they get in contact with you?
Yes. So I have a website, danacasperson.com. That's S-E-N, Casperson.com. And there is all my information about my work and my books. The book is available on booksellers everywhere. Amazon has it. I'm also going to be coming out soon with cards that go with both. I have two books, another book called Changing the Conversation. And everything is available on my website, so they can check it all out there.
Excellent. And all of the details will be in the show notes. So where everyone's seeing or either listening or watching this on YouTube, you'll be able to find all those contact details and organize the book. Are you going to do an audio book with it?
I don't know. We'll see how. I have to talk to the publisher and see what they're doing around that.
Yeah.
The other ways people can reach me is in LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook and Instagram as well.
I think that's how we connected, first of all, was on LinkedIn. Well, no.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for all your sharing, all your expertise. I look forward to hear how your public dialogue goes.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Yeah.
It'll be
Thank
very
you so much.
Interesting. Thank you, Dana. And that's another
so
episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Vosper. Remember to leave a review of the podcast. I'd love to hear your comments as well. I know I have lots of listeners who I've randomly met in different places who tell me they just absolutely love the episodes that they've listened to, but they don't leave the comments. So can you do that? Because that makes me feel very much more connected to you, which I love. Remember, go to JanineVosper.com if you want to book a strategy call and we can have a conversation as well. Have a fantastic day, week, month, wherever you are in the world. And remember to share the We Are Women podcast with your friends and colleagues. Bye-bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.